Welcome to our Goals to Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at the art of novel writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Goals to Conversations. I'm absolutely thrilled today to welcome Kareem Al-Rawi, who is the most wonderful writer. I first met Kareem at the Jaipur Literature Festival, where we were both speaking a few years ago, and I read his wonderful novel, Book of Sands, which I've recommended to many people ever since. Kareem grew up in both of his parents' countries, England and Egypt, which he's going to talk to us about a little bit later. And he's joining us today at the ridiculously early hour of 4 a.m. from Canada. So I'm so impressed. Welcome, Kareem, and thank you for being awake.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you, everybody, for attending.
So your writing career began when you won a BBC competition as an undergraduate. Do you want to tell us about that?
Ooh, that was a long time ago.
Can you remember it?
Yes, vaguely. In those days, people listened to the radio. We didn't have TikTok and other means of entertainment. I was actually, okay, this is the embarrassing bit. I was an engineering student. I was studying engineering at University College London. And being in London, I used to enjoy going to see plays. And one day, one of my colleagues on the course who thought I was an idiot for going to see plays, because, I mean, that's not anything any reasonable person should do, really, I guess, if you're going to be an engineer, said to me he'd seen some kind of a notice from the BBC on, I don't know, the Radio Times or something like that, announcing a radio play competition and inviting submissions. And so if I was such a smart ass, then why didn't I submit something to them? I thought about it, and then I thought, oh, yeah, it'd be interesting to try. I mean, I enjoy listening to radio plays. I enjoy going to see stage plays. So I decided I'd give it a try. And it was a 20-minute radio play. I thought, well, give that. It was actually, yeah, so what's the problem? I'll give it a try, and I won't tell anybody. So that's what I did. I wrote the ready play. Sent it in, and something like 3 or 4 months later, I got this phone call saying the play had won, and that they were going to be putting it on. And it was part of a series called, I think, After Midnight, it was a sort of complete and utter but very pleasant shock.
Had you completely forgotten about it by that point?
Well, almost, yeah. I mean, I assumed I hadn't, and I wasn't going to tell anybody. So, you know, it was... And it was really after that I began thinking that it was maybe a possibility for something that I would enjoy doing. And I graduated as an engineer, and I actually worked for a few years as an engineer. I then went back to do a PhD in structural engineering on the safety and stability of large steel structures. To me, sounds kind of, when I think about it, funny that I would do something like that. But anyway, given everything else that's happened to me, and while I was doing the PhD, I wrote a full-length play and submitted it to the Theatre Royal Stratford East. They accepted it, put it on, and it won an award. It won the John Whiting Award for British and Commonwealth Playwrights. That was a kind of a shock to me too.
And what was the subject of these first two plays? What was the BBC one and then the Stratford East one?
Yeah, the BBC one was about an elderly woman living with her cat. 20 minutes seemed to be a good count, long enough for this. It was a monologue. It was just a monologue. She's talking to her cat. The next one was really set in the East End. I was living in Hackney and just wrote a play about a market there with a mixed population. And those two plays really launched me as a writer, because then Stratford East offered me the position of literary manager. And so I went there as literary manager. And then after that, I was a resident writer at the Royal Court Theatre in Sloane Square. Did that for a couple of years and was churning out stage plays.
Out stage plays, the ease with which you say that. And you became a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company's Writers Group, didn't you? Tell us about that.
There was Hanif Qureshi and myself in that group at the time, and Walter Donoghue, I believe, was the director that was working with us. And we worked on a collaborative play. Didn't really go anywhere because we were all pulling in different directions.
So hard to write with other writers unless you're really got the same style.
And just, if you're on the same wavelength and you're kind of, you have an equal set of interests. It was a bit of a shambles, really, but it was fun. I mean, it was fun while it lasted.
Probably taught you things you weren't even aware you were learning at the time about writing and collaboration.
Well, about writing, about how not to collaborate, yes, but
So then you carried on working for various regional theatres and things. Tell us about when you went to Edinburgh Fringe.
Oh, well, I was, that was an interesting experience, because that was with the theatre company called Joint Stock, which at the time was one of the UK's major touring companies. They toured the play to the Edinburgh Festival, and it won, the play won a Fringe first. I don't know what to say about it, but it was, I haven't actually looked at it or read it or for years.
And all these awards that came in early in your career, that must have been the most extraordinary thing. Did you think this was just going to be it forevermore? You were just going to win an award a year forevermore?
No. I at the time, I'm pretty much an optimist these days, but at the time, I think I was pretty much a pessimist. I was just waiting for the... I was waiting for the, I don't know, the axe to drop or something. They were good years. I mean, I think theatre is... At the time, anyway, it felt like a young person's business or sport or whatever, art form. Of course, now that I've aged somewhat, I don't necessarily think that's the case, but certainly at the time it felt like it. And I kept on thinking, I'd like to do other types of writing, but that while I was still at an age that I thought appropriate for theatre, with the energy to do theatre, because actually it is quite energy consuming with the rehearsals and the rewrites. And the good thing is you learn to rewrite, and after you've had a couple of plays produced, it kind of it softens your ego a bit, because you kind of there's nothing more effective in that way than to be sitting with a group of actors and actors saying, "I can't say these lines," and then you go, "Oh, I thought they were good lines, but if you can't say them, then I got to do something about it."
So you sit there rewriting while you're with the actors and working out how they're...
Oh, I used to go writer. I got so into the rewriting thing that I was rewriting right up to the opening night. And
wow.
And sometimes the directors would say to me, "Please, just back off. Just give me some time to try these lines in different ways, and he'll get it to work or she'll get it to work. So just back off."
I just wonder how on earth they remembered them. If you were writing up almost to the opening night, they've got to then memorize.
Oh, they're brilliant. No, actors are brilliant. I mean, you begin to fall in love with actors working with them, really. We've all had bad experiences, but generally you find a group of actors that you like, and then you really like them. They can be amazing. What they can do and how they commit to a speech or to a character. And they bring it to life. I mean, you're watching. I mean, I remember watching things, watching scenes, and thinking, "Wow, that's scary. That's really kind of that's so, you know," and it makes the let's jump off the page in a way that, as a writer, it's thrilling. To watch.
It must be amazing to watch people bring your creation to life on a stage and to see the audience reaction as well. Would you go along to regular performances, or did you find that you found that too difficult to do?
No, I used to do that. And then I would certainly in the early stages, I would sit there and I'd watch the audience. I'd stop watching the play because by then I knew what the actors were going to do. I'd been in rehearsals. I'd watch them develop the characters, develop the scenes. And then I'd watch the audience during the performances to really try and identify what was working and what wasn't working. I mean, did they look like they were bored? Did they look engaged? And why did they laugh? Why did they not laugh? And so it was a... It was an important experience. I mean, I think I learned a lot that I wasn't aware that I was learning. You know, you kind of absorb things just watching an audience react or not react.
or not react,
yes.
So yeah. to go back now to your childhood. You lived in Cairo until the age of 13, is that correct? And then you moved to London.
I lived in Alexandria.
Is that Alexandria?
Yes.
Until the age of 13, and then moved to London.
Until the age of 13, and then we came to London. Yes. Right. And well, we came to just outside London, Essex. My grandparents were there, so we settled there, and then when I was 18, I moved to London to go to university. So, Alexandrians are a different kettle of fish. Certainly at the time, now not so much, but at the time it was very cosmopolitan, very mixed. There was a Greek community that had been there since, I don't know, Alexander the Great. I mean, no exaggeration. I mean, the city was built for Alexander, named after him. But there was also an Italian community there. There was still a Jewish community. And then obviously, an Egyptian one too, but also from other parts of the Middle East. There was a sizable Moroccan community that had settled in Egypt, and so when I went to school, with a really quite a cosmopolitan group of kids, and that was that was a formative experience too. Although at that age you don't recognize that, but so I've always felt more comfortable in very mixed environments. I mean, there's also a British community. I mean, because of Egypt having been a British colony for a number of decades beforehand. So it was very mixed. And I still consider myself an Alexandrian from that time rather than, I mean, now I go back to Alexandria and it's not really familiar anymore.
Right. That's quite sad, isn't it? Gosh, it's changed so much.
Well, the population has shot up. I mean, it was a maximum of a million. And now it's more like 7 or 8 million. And so there's many more people. The city is much bigger. A lot of the old buildings have been replaced by tower blocks and things. And my grandfather lived in what was then called a Mediterranean villa, which a lot of the houses were like that. They were kind of single-story houses with gardens around them. And now it's all apartment blocks. And so it's different, you know. Things change.
So when you moved to the UK, I mean, that must have been quite extraordinary. How do you think the experiences of living both in Egypt and the UK affected you as a writer when you were growing up?
Whoa. That's a question. Whoa. I think it must have had a profound effect. It was my parents had put the. I actually, for a while, I went to an English school. My primary education, and actually, I mean, interestingly, there was one of the students there. I was to encounter many years later, who also became a writer. His name's Andre Aciman. He's an American writer now in the US. And we were both Alexandrians. He was a bit older than myself at the time. And then my middle school was in Arabic. They decided that. My parents decided that it would be better for me to go to a good Arabic school rather than to the quality of the English schools was deteriorating as many of the British expatriates were leaving. So they decided that they'd put me in an Arabic school. So when I came to England, I had already done a few years in Arabic, and so my conversational English was fine, but really there was a whole lot of school stuff that I just didn't get because my schooling at that stage had been now in Arabic. And so it was a difficult transition initially. I settled, and by the time I was going to university, I was enjoying being in the UK, and I certainly enjoyed my years at university. I think, yeah, so I got from 13 to 18, I think was but maybe a bit of a rough adjustment. But after that, it was kind of smoother sailing.
And then you moved back to Egypt after you'd had kind of lots of success with your plays. Tell us about what took you back to Egypt.
Well, it was partly Margaret Thatcher closing down the theatres.
That'll do it to a playwright.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was thinking, ooh, well, what am I going to do? And then I was offered some teaching at the American University in Cairo. And I thought, oh, okay. I mean, I hadn't been back in, well, since leaving. So it was a large time gap. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll go give it a year and maybe just 6 months. I mean, maybe I'll just give it a semester and see if I like it. And if not, I can come back to England. It ended up being 6 years. I learned to write in Arabic. I wrote four plays in Arabic, but I couldn't seem to get on the right side of the state censor because of the state censorship system. So the plays were banned. As I produced them, they would be banned.
What was that process? I mean, you'd complete them, you'd send them to a theatre, they'd start working on them, and then they'd be banned, or what? Did it not get that far?
Well, no, they had their... I mean, I assume the system's still the same. I don't know. But at the time, what you had to do was you had a theatre would express an interest in something you'd written, and they'd send it to the state censor. So it would arrive on his desk, and it wasn't always a man, though. Sometimes there was... It would kind of vary depending on who decided they were interested in you to go through your work, and they'd go through the play and they would mark the things that they didn't like. So they'd cross things out. They would and then every page gets stamped with the seal of the censor, goes back to the, they send it back to the theatre. So I found they were cutting all sorts of, then what happens is that, you're supposed to then somehow make that work. They've made all sorts of cuts, they've changed things, you're somehow supposed to make that work. And so you can go into a rehearsal, assuming you decide to do that, you go into a rehearsal, they rehearse it, and then before the opening night, you're supposed to then send the final script, which should show the changes that you've made, which should be compatible with what the censor has required. And so at that stage, they can cancel. They can just say, well, no, sorry, you haven't made changes. Or they can say, okay, fine, but we're going to send somebody to the opening night to check that you're not pulling a fast one on us. So they would send somebody you'd have to guarantee two seats on the front row for the censor and whoever accompanies him or her. And they would attend, and if they didn't like something, just in case the actors were going to improvise something that they didn't like, that the censor didn't like, or the actors had agreed to pretend they were saying the right lines, but they were saying the old lines that had been cut out, and they can stop the play there and then.
We've got a question that's come in here about censorship. What were the consequences of not complying with the censor?
Well, I discovered that for myself because after having... I was working on a play that was actually done at the theatre at the mall. What is it? I've forgotten now. There was a small theatre at the mall, in London. So I wrote that play, and then a theatre company in Cairo said it was affiliated to the American University. They said, oh, well, we'd like to, it's an English play, it's a new play, you're teaching here, we'd like to do it with our students, it'll be an amateur production, it won't affect the fact that you're going to get it done in London, but we'll send it to the censor anyway, there shouldn't be a problem. It's in English, and you know, what do they care? But in fact, they did care. The censor said, "Nah, I don't like this play. we don't think you should do it." So basically, the students said, "Well, we still like to do it." So we said, "Okay, we'll do it, but we'll do it just for the students. It's not going to be a public performance or anything." So we just did it, almost like a public reading, but it wasn't public. It was just for the student body and the faculty, and we just did one performance. But the censor found out that it was done and was, for some reason, particularly irritated. And demanded that I go and see him. So I did. And I went to his offices, and he basically lectured me. I mean, who do you think you are? You can't decide what you put on. You can't decide what goes on the stage. That's the prerogative of the state censor. And he said to me, "I want you to make the following changes." And I said, "Well, what's for? I'm not doing it again here." He said, "No, but you've already told me that you're going to do it. It's going to be produced in London. So I want you to make these changes before you produce it in London." And I said, "No, but well, it's none of your business." I said, "None of your business." And he said to me, "You have 2 weeks." So I said, "Well, I'm not doing it. Wow. No. I'm not going to produce the play again in Cairo, so that's it." So he was quite irate. He told me, don't provoke me. Anyway, I didn't respond after 2 weeks. A bit later, the university got a letter saying, "You're not allowed to do any plays by this ruffian who's teaching at your theater department." So I said, "Fine," I said, "I'm not bothered." But then I decided, sitting around with some friends who were actors, having a couple of beers, one of them said to me, "Why don't you write something in Arabic?" And I thought, well, I've never done that before, and it's kind of sound a little, I felt a little intimidated about the idea of writing in Arabic. I've written plays in English. I considered English to be my writing language. My Arabic had, by that stage, having been away from Egypt for so long, was, again, basically at a conversational level and not at a literary level. But I decided, okay, I'll do one about censorship. And I chose to do a play about a poet who was a real life poet, basically based on his life, who faced some extreme challenges in terms of censorship. And I wrote the play. And the actors that I'd been sitting with said, "Well, we love it. We want to do it." And then I said to them, "But what about the censor?" And they said, "Well, let's just send it into him and see how he reacts. And then we can decide what to do afterwards."
And did you know, decide? Could you have sent it in and under a pseudonym, or did it have to come in under your own name?
Well, we sent it in under my own name. When you're kind of young and foolish, you kind of do these kind of things. So we sent it in, and I got ordered back in to see the censor. And he was now kind of livid. Absolutely livid. Basically taking it as a personal insult, but this was a play about censorship, and with the implication basically that censorship's a bad thing. And he had to persuade me that it's actually a good thing, because it actually protects the writer from any crazies around who might decide to do something terrible to you because they disagree with you. And I said, "Well, the kind of people who do that kind of thing don't come to my plays. Too boring for them." But anyway, he told me, he said to me, "Look, I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to pretend I didn't see this script. Just don't produce it. Don't bring it in. Don't talk to me about it. Don't talk to anybody about it. I didn't see it. I'm doing you a favor. Believe me. Just go home and stop being such a nuisance. So I went back to my actor friends. We had a few more beers and we decided, well, let's put it on. But what we do is we check the legal situation to see what constitutes a production, because the sense has jurisdiction over public production. So if we do something that doesn't fit the definition of a public production, can we get away with it? And so that's what we did. We found a theater that was actually about to be demolished. And we talked to the owner. Could we have it for a couple of weeks? And he said, sure, you know, it's going to be demolished. I don't care. So fine. So we took over this theater. And then one of the requirements is that it must have a public performance is a performance at a place where you can, where the front doors open onto a public space. So it could be a street or a square or a, so we said, well, we're not going to open the front doors. We'll open the back doors. That's an alleyway. Alleyways are considered sort of private because they go to people's homes. So it's like a driveway. So we'll do that. It's a public performance if you sell tickets. So we're not going to sell tickets. It's going to be free to the public. There were a couple of other things, like you're not allowed to do it's a public performance if you advertise publicly. So we said, okay, we won't do that. We put posters up in, certainly at the time, and I still think so now, there were lots of private galleries, art galleries in Cairo. There are a lot of artists, very good ones there as well. And they exhibit in these private galleries. So we decided we'd put up posters in the private galleries. So we did a number of things like that that satisfied the legal requirement that it's not a public performance. And we put on the play. And shortly afterwards, I was arrested and taken for interrogation by state security for disruptive behavior. So that's what happened.
So there. That is the answer, Sue, to what happens if you defy the censor. Well,
yeah.
So that led to you, am I right, setting up a censorship monitoring unit? Tell us about that and how you got away with that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I came out of that meeting kind of a little shaken because these guys really kind of, they're big and burly and they threaten to beat the hell out of you if you don't comply and stuff like that. I mean, they're not very polite. And I thought, well, I need some kind of protection. I didn't know any mafioso types that I could hire to deal with these guys. So I thought the next best thing was go to the human rights organization that had recently been set up. Because it was full of lawyers. And, it's not much, at the time anyway, I didn't think there was much difference between protection from a lawyer and a mafioso. But it's probably unfair. If there are any lawyers in the audience, I apologize. It's just a joke, really. It was really just one guy in a desk at the time. And so I got chatting to him, and he asked to read the script. He read the script, and he said, "This is great. I really love it, you know." And we got chatting, and he said, "Well, you know, you can help us out here because it's all volunteers, and It's a room with a desk and a chair. That was all it was at the time. And he said, we could do with somebody monitoring censorship. And I said, I can do that. So that's how we set up the monitoring unit. And I then started doing other things for them, like grant applications from various organizations, such as the Norwegians were offering money for human rights work in Egypt. And so nobody at the time in the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, as far as I was aware, had experience of writing grants and proposals for projects and stuff like that. So I started doing that for them. And then they needed a spokesperson to deal with the foreign press. So I started doing that. And really, that was a good experience. I mean, I learned a lot. And that kind of led to another session with state security. And that was much more, actually much more intimidating.
Yeah. So by this point, you were married with young children, isn't that right? And they kind of took you away from your family. Is that what I'm thinking?
Yes. I was in the street walking home when it was about 9 o'clock at night. And a group of police, what seemed to be policemen, but probably state security officers, basically stopped me as I was about to enter the building where we had an apartment, and said to me, are you Kerry Marowe? And I said, yes. And they said, well, we'd like you to come with us. And I said, well, I'd prefer not to. And the officer said, come on, it's really simple. You know, you come with us, there's no hassle. We'll take you. You'll do another interview with one of our commanders. And maybe you're lucky, they'll let you out. Maybe they'll hold you for a bit, but, you know, it'll be fine. Which I knew wasn't true, wasn't going to be fine. He said, the alternative is you go upstairs, you go in, we'll give you 10 minutes, and then we'll come smash down the door, beat the shit out of you in front of your kids and wife, and take you. So, well, it's your choice. So I said, okay, I'll come with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
you had a pretty grim time, didn't you? But tell us how you got out of that situation, which is even more another extraordinary story.
Well, I mean, I was basically held for a few days, and they strip searched me. And I talked to one of the lawyers at the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, who I befriended for a while. And I actually asked him, he'd been arrested several times. And he told me basically, there's one of two things. He said, you have to decide one of two things. Either you tell everything or you tell them nothing. He said, there's no middle ground. You have to decide. What's your strategy? Either way, you're gonna get a beating. But it's something you're gonna have to decide for yourself what to do. And I talked to somebody else who said to me that he used this expression, which is respect yourself, which in Arabic carries a kind of very strong kind of connotation of behave yourselves kind of thing. But it's the idea of respecting yourself is like kind of don't do anything that you'd say that to a younger person who's thinking of doing something that may shame their family or family is really strong and many Middle Eastern countries. I mean, you really kind of you can do things that are really appalling, but as long as it doesn't shame the family, you kind of get away with it. So when they came to, finally took me into interrogation, they put me in a kind of storage room with a whole group of young people who were really terrified, who were younger than myself, students mainly, that they'd arrested for a demonstration, for holding a demonstration. And I mean, I was watching kind of young men who were 19, 20, 21 years old, things like that, kind of weeping. I mean, they were kind of in terror. I decided that, I mean, I was 10 years older than them, something like that, that I wasn't going to do that. And I thought, I somehow felt I had to set the example because I was the oldest one in the room, even though I was only in my 30s, my kind of mid-30s, late 30s, something like that. And so I decided that I wasn't going to play ball. So when they took me in for interrogation, they had these three officers standing around me, and I had to sit in a chair. And one of them did all the talking, and every time he'd get threatening, I'd say to him, "Please respect yourself." And I noticed that he kind of would throw him. Finally, he said to me, "Who are you? Who are you?" And I knew then that I'd actually been pressing the right button, because "who are you" meant really, who are you related to? Are how dare you speak to a security officer this way unless you're somehow related to somebody in government or somebody with a lot of influence? And my response would be, I'm not answering any questions till you tell me what the charges are. And then he'd go kind of crazy a bit and start yelling at me and threatening. And then he'd come up looking like he's about to punch me or slap me. And I'd say to him, "Please respect yourself." And then he'd kind of step back. And then they decided, clearly, they didn't know what to do with me. So they sent me down into the basement where they kind of threw me in a cell. Having kind of strip searched me and taken my wallet and all my stuff. And then it was only a bit later that I was called up about, I don't know, three, four days later, having kind of gone up and down several times for interrogation. They then called me in, and they'd been through the cards that were in my wallet, and one of them was from Iowa State University, where I'd actually done a residency, and it was an ID card that they gave me so that I could use the facilities of the university. And the guy said to me, "What is this?" And I said, "An ID card." And he said, "Are you an American citizen?" And I said, "Does it matter?" And he said, "You son of a bitch, you're getting me into serious trouble. They'll hold me out. My boss will hold me over the coals for interrogating an American." And I didn't contradict him because I'm not an American, but I didn't contradict him because I thought, I should be here. He started, he talked himself into a state of kind of a really a groveling state. It was.
Wow.
And I just realized, I mean, these guys were all trained by Americans. I mean, these men are torturers. They're terrified of the Americans, which means that, or threatening an American. means that they were trained by Americans and that they were basically, this is what they were trained to do. I mean, it's...
And having a British passport hadn't protected you, but this
nothing.
American ID did. It's scary, isn't it?
I'm sure. British passport, sure.
Now, I'm going to move this on because we've only got 15 minutes left, which is just gutting, and we haven't talked about the rest of your writing. So I'm going to do a bit of a whistle-stop tour.
Okay.
You went to America, even though you aren't an American citizen. You ended up working in America. Tell us about some of the work that you did there, because you got a Fulbright scholarship, am I right?
Yes. I mean, friends of mine in the States, when they heard about my arrest and what happened, then really pulled out the stops for me, and they helped me do this application for Fulbright. I got a Fulbright, and then I got residencies at American theaters and at an American university, and produced plays. My plays were produced there. I had a production off Broadway of a play, and then really right across the country. Stage plays. And when I was in the US, sorry, when I was in Egypt, I'd been writing for a number of publications, including The Guardian, pieces about the situation in Egypt. So I also started writing, doing more journalism in the US, and got appointed as a magazine editor, and became editor-in-chief, and was a managing editor of a different another magazine. And so that was basically how I kept myself going in those years as a writer in the US.
And before we get on to, I wanted a bit later to talk about what you did with the American government as well, but let's talk about Book of Sands, because your novel is just beautiful. And it's so frustrating. If there's any publishers out there, why is this not published in the UK? It's the most gorgeous book, and it's really hard to get hold of over here. Tell us about Book of Sands. I have bought this for many people because I absolutely love it, and I just want people to know about it. So tell us how you got working on it.
Well, what happened was that... yeah, I mean, it's based on what happened during the Arab Spring, and it's a work of fiction, so it's partly fantasy, partly based on actual events. And generally, I like doing that in my writing. I write fiction, therefore I feel I have a license to invent story. But I like it to be a story that's rooted in some kind of a reality. So that's what Book of Sands, that's the style of Book of Sands. And it's it's about the Arab Spring, which was 2011, when there was an uprising in Cairo against the dictatorship of the Mubarak family. President Mubarak, who was, a dictator, a military dictator, wanted... There seemed to be plans to get his son to replace him, so it would be a hereditary presidency, which is kind of contradictory, and the most people in the country were not... Well, they were averse to that idea, and there was an uprising demanding democracy. And by that stage, I was in Canada, and I decided to. I felt as somebody who'd kind of gone through the experience of that many others had of arrested and interrogation and stuff like that, that it would be interesting to go back and see what was going on. So I did. I went back, and I joined the back with the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, the many of the people who I knew when I was there before were still at the organization, and so I spent time working with them, collecting data on people who were arrested, people who were interrogated, people who were killed, who were in Tahrir Square, in Liberation Square, protesting the dictatorship and calling for democracy. And I stayed there till that phase was over, that Mubarak fell, was no longer president, and actually was arrested. And there was a period of some months where it looked like the country was headed towards a democratic system, but then there was yet another military coup, and the system was reverted back to an even worse military dictatorship than existed before. So the novel really is based on that experience of being there and what I witnessed while I was there.
And it's beautifully written. It kind of almost feels, I don't know if you're going to hate this description, it almost feels like magic realism. I got so caught up in it. But do you love that description or hate it?
No, I don't. I don't love it or hate it. It's
you consider your own writing to be.
No, it's fine. I mean, it's there are parts of it that are fantastical, which would fit that description. So, I mean, I'm not averse to the label.
to being compared to Gabriel García Márquez.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah.
So you teach as well. Tell us about the Iowa Writing School.
Well, the University of Iowa has a writing department, which is constantly voted or identified as the best in, certainly in North America, if not globally. I was involved with the department that is the International Writers Program. And the International Writers Program would bring over writers from different countries, mostly on U.S. government grants, but not all. We would run courses for them on creative writing. So I was one of the instructors, one of the three principal instructors. And I did that for about 4 years.
And teaching writing is, I think, also a wonderful way of improving your own writing, isn't it? Did you find that when you were working with students that it kind of kickstarted more creativity in you?
Up to a point. I mean, I'm kind of skeptical about a lot of these programs, the teaching creative writing, to be honest with you. I don't think most of them do any teaching. I mean, it's... The students are brought into a workshop. They sit around and they discuss each other's work. Well, that's fine, but where's the instruction? I mean, they're not really getting any real instruction. So I tried to do things a little differently. I taught a course in what was called global literature. So I got a course so that'd be. We'd be discussing writers from across different cultures, whether Russian or Middle Eastern or American or British, or in one case it was a Chinese writer that we were looking at his work, and get them to think about getting them to think about different ways of telling a story, of how it's structured, of plots you don't write plotless novels, even though we use that term quite frequently. There's always a plot. It's either a strong plot or it's a weak plot, but there's always a plot, because the plot is the causal chain within a story. It's the causal chain, and you do have a causal chain. And if you break that causal chain, that too is part of a plot. I mean, you're doing an anti-plot in a way, but it's there. It's so there are things like that I think it's useful for young writers to be thinking about, if nothing else. And I don't think there's enough of that kind of stimulation in these courses. They're kind of somewhat lazily done, I think. We have them come into a workshop, they sit around, they do their own writing, then they critique each other. And, you know, it's potluck as to whether the group you've got together are any good at criticizing each other's work, or whether they're just kind of going to be competitive. They're just going to be competitive and insult each other. Because that also happens. I'd never read a book like that, or I'd never read that story. It's dreadful. It's awful.
And then you've got to be a referee and keeping them apart. No. So we're really running out of time, but I want you to tell us very quickly about your children's books, particularly the most recent one. This is a children's literary cookbook. What a great idea.
Yes. It's called Ab Fairy Tale Feasts. I was working on my second novel, which I'm almost done with, I hope. Fingers crossed, touch wood. I'm kind of in the editing stage of that. And I was approached by a publisher. He's a British-Canadian publisher. So the book's published in the UK as well as in Canada. And I'd written a couple of children's books before, and he wanted something a little different. And we came up with this idea of a literary cookbook. So it's a book with recipes, which I've simplified so that they are suitable for to do with children. So you need an adult in the kitchen, but that basically you can have a young person assisting. And then fairy tales that I've written that are kind of modeled on Middle Eastern fairy tales, like Thousand and One Nights type stories, and then sort of general information about foods, Middle Eastern food and stuff like that, and so that's what that is, and then it's really, I mean, personally, I think the illustrations
crucial. But I mean, so you're just, we've had comments coming in saying how creative you are. I mean, you write plays, you do journalism, incredible novels, children's books. Your different types of writing are absolutely amazing. And there's so much we haven't touched on. We haven't had a chance to talk about your second novel, which at the moment is called The Burning Book. Is that right? But of course, as we all know, it may change when publishers get a hold of it. Who knows? Yeah. But I can't wait for that to come out because, as I say, love Book of Sands, another plug there. Needs a UK publisher, somebody out there, publish Book of Sands, please, so it's easy to get. You've worked for the US State Department after 9/11. You've supervised media training programs on conflict mitigating, reporting in 14 countries from Morocco to Nepal. I mean, your track record is absolutely astonishing, and I wish we could talk for longer, but we can't. So we're going to have to do something again. Thank you so much for coming along, Kareem. It's now what it's about 5 o'clock in the morning with you. Now you can have a great writing day.
Well, thank you, and thank you everybody who's attended. It's been a pleasure.
And we've got one last question we have to ask: is, are you going to write an autobiography?
No, probably.
Well, I think you should team up with a biographer and get them to do it with you. So that's our plan, I think. And I'm just telling you that now. thank you so much, Kareem. It's been an absolute joy. And have a great rest of your day. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you all. Okay, bye.
And just to say, everybody, this is not goodbye. I am going to be doing some things with the Goldstone magazine. It won't be as frequent as we have been doing until now, but I am booked already for the end of March, 26th of March. It's a Tuesday now, 1 till 2 p.m. on Tuesdays. I will be talking to Sarah Barnes, who has written two amazing books, one nonfiction, one fiction, about the benefits of cold water swimming. So we are going to have the most fascinating conversation. And I think she might be trying to get me into it. I don't know. Let's see. We're not doing it from a cold water swimming pool, though. We'll be doing it, as usual, on Zoom. And there are lots of changes happening on Goldster, as you know, but hopefully we may even be able to start doing Book of the Month, even if it's Book of the Quarter. Who knows? But thank you so much for all your feedback. It is being listened to, and we're very, very grateful. I'm particularly grateful. And just a joy to have so many of you here today. And Karim is a dear friend as well. Thank you so much for coming on today. Take care, everybody. I will see you at the end of the month. And Joe, I'm sorry we've gone slightly over, but thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.